I want to talk about something that happened a little more than a year ago, on January the 19th, 2004, almost exactly a year ago. On that day, there were 100,000 people who marched on the streets of Baghdad. It was certainly the largest demonstration since the war, but by some measures, it was the largest political demonstration in Iraq in 30 years. There'd been religious demonstrations, but there hadn't been just a purely non-state demonstration. Absolutely peaceful. There were 30,000 people in Basra, same time. They marched through the streets of Baghdad, and they chanted, "Yes, yes, elections, no, no, selections." They also chanted, "Yes, yes, elections, no, no, occupation." They were demonstrating against what was called the November 15th plan, which was a plan that was cooked up by Paul Bremer, the former chief envoy in Iraq, and his bosses in Washington, to deal with the fact that Iraqis were demanding elections, were rejecting their economic reforms, the fact that even their hand-picked appointees on the Iraqi Governing Council were saying, we're not going to go ahead and privatize Iraq because while it's under occupation because it's illegal under the Geneva Conventions. And they didn't know what to do because none of the investors could come under these conditions because none of the insurance companies would offer them insurance to come to Iraq. So they had this problem, which is they've invaded this country, they've rewritten all of the laws to make it the most liberal investment environment anywhere in the world. In fact, Donald Rumsfeld said, Iraq now has some of the most progressive economic laws anywhere in the Western world. And he said anywhere in the free world, forgetting that it was actually under occupation. They had a 15% flat tax, and it's interesting, when this flat tax was introduced under occupation, they went from having a 40% tax rate for corporations, which is, you know, fairly standard, to having this 15% flat tax. And as, you know, as we all know, the Republicans are obsessed with this idea of the flat tax. And Iraqi business people were worried about what this was going to mean, whether they were going to be able to compete with all of these American multinationals coming to their country, especially because they didn't have any electricity and they, you know, didn't have emergency generators for their factories. They were going, welcome to the wonderful free market, compete after 13 years of sanctions, after not being able to replace a spare part with no electricity. Welcome to the free market in the dark, right? And meanwhile, cheap imports are flooding across the border and these guys are being told to compete. So they said to Paul Bremer's deputy, a guy named Michael Fleischer, Ari Fleischer's brother, Ari Fleischer, the former press secretary for the White House, they said, how are we going to be able to compete? We're going to be driven out of business. And Michael Fleischer, he sort of acted like the guy on Survivor. He said, only the best of you will survive. You will be voted off of your country. And then he said, besides, the entire Republican Party is envious of your tax law. So, I mean, this is the level of utopian euphoria that had gripped these guys. The idea of what in one place on earth, they were just going to erase this country and rebuild it from scratch. That's why they didn't mind that, you know, the museums were being looted, that the libraries were being looted, because the more destruction there was, this is the great Christian myth of redemptive violence. Here, I mean, it's a good place to talk about it. Cleansing through violence. Okay? This is one of the most dangerous ideas in the world. These guys believed it. And so they thought that the more violence there was, the more perfectly Iraq could be reborn through the nucleus, which was the only building that they protected, the oil ministry. That would be the nucleus of the new Iraq. Paul Bremer went to Washington. He said, we've got a problem. The natives are getting restless. They want democracy. And our investors won't come under these conditions. We're going to lose it all. So they came up with a new plan. They said, OK, we're going to have an interim government. We're going to have an interim government that we appoint. But you know, you can't trust these Iraqis, obviously, because they're already starting to express some of their ideas of their own, even our own appointed Iraqis. So we need something to control them. We're going to write them a constitution before they get elections. This seemed like a great idea. We'll write them a constitution. Now, the Iraqis, apparently, and we hear this a lot, they didn't have a culture of democracy. They didn't have a culture of democracy because they lived under dictatorship for so long. So they didn't understand that democracy means having foreigners invade your country, write your laws, and then you're... So they had this crazy idea, which was that they should write their own constitution after they had elected their politicians. Well, this was wrong. This was wrong. They needed to go to democracy school. And they had democracy schools all over Iraq, so that they were run by a North Carolina company called the Research Triangle Institute. Research Triangle Institute's based in Raleigh, North Carolina. I went to visit them. It's interesting because in the older colonial times, they would redraw the borders of Iraq and the British Parliament and make grand speeches, you know, very flowery and so on. And, you know, they would talk about the divine duty of empire and so on. Now it's done in like this bad industrial park in Raleigh, North Carolina, and like guys in bad suits. And they're like, okay, I've never been to Iraq, but I think, you know, if we're going to privatize the water, we need to, you know, empower these local councils because it's easier to make deals with them because none of them can afford lawyers. And so that's what RTI's contract was. It was a $500,000 contract over 3 years to build local governments, appoint local councils, 18 of them across Iraq, to teach Iraqis about civil society. I talked to a lot of Iraqis about this. They said, we're not civilized. They have to teach us about civil society. We go to civil society workshops. But the problem was is that when RTI would get to these towns, they'd go to Hilla, they'd go to Najaf, they'd go to Samarra, they'd gone and elected themselves councils by the time the RTI got there. Well, and RTI would come with flow charts. They'd be like, okay, look, cancel these elections. You know, you have to develop a culture of democracy first. We need to teach you about civil society, all this stuff Michael Ignatieff likes so much. And so they literally canceled Paul Bremer. They had this problem of an outbreak of democracy right after the elections, where even Mosul, the third largest city in Iraq, 2 months after the invasion, had gone and elected themselves a city council. That would not do. So the elections were called off where they had already taken place. The results were nullified, and they went and put generals in charge of each of these cities who they could deal with, a local strongman. Basically the same thing they've done in Afghanistan. So the demands of the protesters on the streets on January 19th, 2003 was they didn't want an interim government at all. They looked at the plan and they said, we don't see why we have to have an interim government. Why don't we just have elections now? Why don't we have elections in 6 months from now? And our next government can be elected, just like you promised, because that was the promise when Iraq was first invaded. And they said, and why don't we write the constitution afterwards? And in fact, Iraq's pre-invasion constitution had better protections for women and minority rights than what they have now. So this whole thing was a sham. By using women's rights, systematically women's rights and feminism are being used as an excuse to lock in these economic reforms. Believe me, these guys will sell women out at the drop of a hat, and they did in the drafting of the interim constitution. But, so that was the demand. The U.S. said, no, these elections, when 100,000 people were marching in Baghdad, they had this problem. And the reason why they had another problem was that the week before, David Kaye had announced that Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction. So the primary excuse for invading the war had just disappeared. And now they were saying it's all about democracy, but there's 100,000 people on the street saying we want elections, and you have George Bush and Paul Bremer going, we can't have elections. So they gave a couple of reasons why they couldn't. They said the security situation is too bad. This was more than a year ago. The security situation in January of 2004 was so many times better than what the situation under which they just had these elections. It's indescribable. For instance, it was safe enough that you could have 100,000 people on the streets of Baghdad. By the time I arrived in Baghdad a few months later, the idea of a mass demonstration was almost unthinkable. People were so afraid to be in the streets because the violence had increased so much. Salim Lon, who was the advisor to Sergio Melo, who was the Kofi Annan's envoy to Iraq, who was killed in the UN bombing. Salim Lon wrote a piece in the International Herald Tribune last week where he said that the violence in Iraq really started when we started to break the promise of delivering democracy and liberation to Iraq. And he was in the UN when it was bombed, and he lost 22 of his colleagues. And he said it was when Paul Bremer announced that he would appoint the Iraqi Governing Council instead of electing them. It was when he appointed them that afterwards the UN was bombed. And he believes that there was a causal relationship between these two incidents. And all along, all of these betrayals have ramped up the violence. So democracy has been fought in Iraq systematically at every stage because it represented, if real democracy came to that country, it would have nullified the reasons they went to war. That's why they had to fight it at every stage. And they spent 2 years defanging democracy, neutering it, making sure that it was born still. That by the time Iraqis finally got to the polls, there would be nothing left to vote for, because all of the key decisions would already have been made. And let me talk a little bit about this constitution that they wrote. Now, Paul Bremer wrote these sets of laws that were the free trade wish list. Foreign companies can come in, buy 100% of the assets, take 100% of the profits out, the 15% flat tax, intellectual property rights for Monsanto, you can't keep seeds. I mean, whatever. It was NAFTA, the World Trade Organization, the FTAA, all rolled up into one. And why not? Because they didn't have to negotiate with anyone. That's the really great part about being an occupier. There is no government. You are negotiating with yourself. You lock yourself in the green zone, write the rules, and sign them. And that's what Paul Bremer did. And then they wrote this constitution, and they put in this clause, this very overlooked clause, because once again, when we debated the constitution, there was this whole sham debate about women's rights, ignoring the fact that women's rights were protected under the previous constitution. So they put in a clause, and the clause said, all of the coalition provisional authority's orders, all of these laws that I've just described, cannot be changed or altered or amended in any way during the transitional government. So that is the period that we just left. That's why there were no changes while there was an interim appointed government. But now, even now that there have been elections, according to this transitional constitution, according to this interim constitution that they passed, the only way that you can change the constitution is if you have unanimity of the three people. There's going to be a prime minister and two deputies, which will be chosen by this council. I know it's incredibly bureaucratic, but they didn't just elect a prime minister. They elected a council of 275 people. Those people are going to appoint or elect a prime minister and two deputies. Now, chances are that one of those people is going to be Iyad Alawi or somebody else equally manageable, one of the three. And all it takes is one person to block it, and they can't make a single change to any of these laws. That's what I mean by locking in these reforms. But just to make sure they're really locked away good, they also did the Iraqis the great favor of renegotiating their foreign debt while they were still being run by occupiers. And a deal was struck in November. Once again, very important that it was done before elections. It was a deal between the so-called Iraqi government and the Paris Club, which is the rich industrialized nations, who owned 40% of Iraq's debt. And they negotiated a debt reduction, which was heralded as wonderful generosity that they had forgiven 80% of the debt that Iraq owed to them. And this, you know, made the news. What wasn't reported were the strings attached. And this is a very old story. They agreed to write down 80% of Iraq's debt so long as Iraq agreed to abide by a structural adjustment program that they had negotiated with the International Monetary Fund, which demanded the privatization of the state companies, which demanded the end of the food subsidy program, where all Iraqis receive a food basket. It's basically the only thing that works in the country right now. And 60% of Iraqis are dependent on this food basket for basic nutrition, according to UNICEF. They see this as a relic of state socialism. In fact, it's a relic of the sanctions. And they think it should be eliminated and people should be given $15 a month to spend in the market economy. So these are the key decisions, of course, that are going to affect the future of the country. And they were systematically locked in and signed away with the key thrown away leading up to these elections. So I think that we need to be very careful about how we talk about these elections, because I think that they do speak to an incredible hunger and desire and right to freedom and sovereignty and democracy. And they absolutely should be supported and applauded and not mocked. I think but at the same time, we also have to know that this is a very old story, and it's a story of how people who fight and die for freedom in great liberation struggles around the world are sold out in these transition periods. You know, there was another news story that came out last week in the run-up to the happy elections. The headline was, U.S. cannot account for $9 billion of Iraq's oil money. Maybe it was a little bit different than that, but basically they lost $9 billion. That's the bottom line. The CPA lost $9 billion, not of their own money, but of Iraq's oil money. And this came out because there's an annual audit. And the auditor said that $9 billion had been paid to appointed Iraqi politicians without providing any receipts or any accounting for where that money went. So as we watch the next few weeks, I mean, we don't know who the next government is. I've never seen elections that people are so excited about the fact of them and so uninterested in who wins. And I think that should be very telling. Never has the U.S. government been so completely uninterested in who wins elections in a country where it is intimately involved. The reason why they don't care is not just because these key decisions have already been locked away, but because so many people have been systematically bought off. You don't lose $9 billion to your appointed politicians by mistake. And that really is why they needed those 2 years. They needed those 2 years to lock in all sides of this, at the IMF, at the legal and constitutional level, but also to bribe people so that they will occupy themselves, because it's cheaper. And they can pull back to their bases, which is what they want, and outsource the occupation to their surrogates. That's the place we're at right now. I think we need to think about this moment in the context of how many past betrayals have taken place in Iraq, how many previous occasions on which freedom has been promised and then been betrayed, thinking about it in the context of the financial and military support for Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq War, because he was seen as being important to control the spread of Islamic nationalism more than anything else. And also the betrayal in 1991, when the Shias were told by George Bush's father to rise up and topple their dictator and that they would be supported, and they were left to be slaughtered. That's when most of the recent mass graves took place, in which the Canada was part of that war, and the United Nations, and it's not something that can just be pinned on the Bushes. That was the worst betrayal. And then the betrayal of the sanctions, where, yes, everybody knew that Saddam was very well taken care of, and that the people who were being systematically targeted, who were suffering, were the poorest of the poor, were once again actually the same people who were told to rise up and were left to be sacrificed. These are the people who had no water infrastructure because it had been bombed and then it wasn't fixed under the sanctions. And then the betrayal of the promise of liberation that turned into brutal occupation. And now these elections, which, as I've said, are on the verge of being another great betrayal. But I actually don't believe it has to be that way. I don't believe it has to be that way because these elections, the only reason they took place at all is because of the relentless and courageous demands taking place inside Iraq, that people have risked their lives again and again, taking to the streets and forcing their occupiers to deliver on the promise of democracy and liberation. And they've been dragged kicking and screaming all along. And as I've described, they have finally caved in to the hollowest form of democracy imaginable. That said, there was one good thing that happened, which is the United Nations, when the U.S. appointed the interim government for the June 28th handover, it was supposed to be the June 30th handover, they needed a United Nations Security Council resolution to recognize the new government. And in the original text of the Security Council resolution, they also asked for them to recognize the Constitution as the legitimate law of Iraq. But Sistani intervened, and he said that the Constitution is illegal, it was written under occupation, and it should not be ratified by the UN. And the US was in such a rush to get the Security Council to pass this resolution, because by this point Bush was on the election campaign trail, and he really needed his resolution, and he needed this handover to take place. So they caved, the US caved, and they took out the reference to the Constitution. So what I just described about how they can't change the laws, that Constitution is in place, and they're trying to pass it on to this next government, but it's never been ratified by the United Nations. So if the new government decides that they don't want to be bound by any of these laws, they are absolutely within their rights to do that. And that should be and can be their first act as a sovereign government, to just tear up all of Paul Bremer's economic reforms, all of his laws that he never had a right to write in the first place. Because we know this story. We know this story. We know it. We know it from South Africa, one of the greatest liberation struggles of our time. I was in South Africa a couple of years ago. I went to a meeting in Soweto of the Soweto Electricity Crisis Committee, this incredible direct action group, where when the electricity that's being privatized gets cut off, the struggle electricians who used to work for the electricity company but got laid off go and reconnect the electricity, and they do the same with the water, the struggle plumbers. And what they're saying is the ANC was a democratic movement that was fighting for democratic rights that were about more than just voting. They were about the right to water. They were about the right to housing. They were about the right to work. It was a whole package that understood that voting is just a symbolic part of democracy and that it's meaningless without the right to dignity and the right to survive. And they are insisting. They're not saying we don't believe in democracy. They're saying we want it all. We want deep democracy. We want what we were promised. And at this meeting, there was an old man who stood up at this meeting of the Soweto Electricity Crisis Committee, and he lost a leg in one of the Soweto uprisings. And he said, you know, I fought for freedom in this country, and now my water's just been cut off. This is not what I fought for. But he is still fighting. And we have seen democracy movements betrayed across Latin America in these transition periods. Finally, Argentina finally freed from the brutal dictators, the generals who disappeared 30,000 people, particularly trade unionists, because it was economic genocide. It was political genocide against the left. Finally freed, and in the transition, the deal is made. You'll inherit the debts of your dictators. They ran up the debt from $6 billion to $46 billion, and the democratic Argentina had to pay the debts of their dictators, who ran up the debt, building concentration camps in which they were disappeared. This is when the deals are made, in these transition periods, when people are so happy that they're going to get a little bit of freedom, that sometimes they don't see how much freedom is actually being negotiated away. What's going on in Iraq isn't happening in the past tense. We're not talking about a past betrayal. It's unfolding in real time. It's unfolding right now. And people are resisting it with everything they have against tremendous, unthinkable military might and winning incredible victories. You know, when I think about that protest in January, last January, I get really sad, because I think, where the hell were we? Where the hell were we? You know, 10 million people, or by some accounts, 35 million people marched against the war on the eve of invasion. But when Iraqis marched in their streets and said, we want the democracy and the freedom that we were promised, we should have mirrored that protest in our cities. We should have been there saying, yes, yes, election, no, no, selection. And we should have done it in Washington, we should have done it in Vancouver, we should have done it in Ottawa, we should have done it in London, because they were screaming at their occupiers. We should have done it here. And I believe that if we had, I think that they would have won. And I think that we need to think about how we mirror those demands, the demands for total debt erasure, not to pay for any of the debts of their dictator or of their occupiers, or to be bound by any of the structural adjustment programs that have been illegally negotiated by their occupiers and their surrogates. This is what self-determination means. So, I think we have our work cut out for us. I think that this should be the dawn of a new kind of anti-war movement that isn't just about symbolically saying, not in our name, we marched, we were against it. Not about proving ourselves right. You know, this question, was the left wrong about Iraq? Who the hell cares? The issue is, will anything positive happen at this moment? What will we do to support the people in Iraq who don't care whether we were right or we were wrong, but who are fighting right now for their sovereignty, for their self-determination, for their freedom? Will we worry about our anti-war egos and say, well, we think nothing good could ever come of war, so we're not even going to bother supporting them now? We must support them now. That's our duty. And I believe that it's more than our duty. I think it is the blueprint for what our future movements will look like, because it will be a combination of the best of our anti-capitalist analysis with the best of our anti-imperialist analysis, the best of our anti-racist analysis, the best of our anti-war analysis, to create a movement that is genuinely for democracy and self-determination. Thank you.